baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and you fill in the blank. Summer and Chevy go together like road trips and sunshine. Check out the full line of Chevy SUVs and trucks at your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealers today. Chevy, drive Chicago.
Listening to Steve Bertrand on books. I'm glad you are. Thanks for checking us out this week. Jamel White is being called a powerful new voice in Irish literature, and it's easy to see why. All Them Dogs is his debut novel. It centers around the tough guys in West Dublin, including and especially this young man named Tony Ward, as he tries to navigate the gangs, the thugs, his love life, his family, and just about everything else. Jamel, welcome. How are you?
Very well, Steve. How are you?
I'm well. So, The Guardian calls this, the review, a fast-paced crime thriller with a psychosexual twist. Is that a good definition for you, or how would you define it?
I think it's an apt definition. I would definitely consider it to be maybe a literary thriller with, a tale of desire kind of woven through. I'm not sure how psycho the sexual aspect is. It's a lot very much about identity and belonging. And I think it's more of an emotional story than a psychological story, for me anyway.
Yeah, I get that. I think it's a very emotional story. And I want to get to the book in a couple of minutes. But first, I want to talk about your journey, because you're what we in the States would call a school dropout, right? You dropped out of school.
Yeah.
And now you're an Irish force in literature.
I appreciate that. I dropped out when I was 17. So I was closing really towards the last 6 months of my final year in school. And I just had enough. It was whatever I was going through at the time was becoming too much for me. And I sought out alternative paths. And I was fortunate in the sense that found paths that set me on the right track. It was very much the long way around that I took, but I think I was all the better for it, because there was room to do some kind of crucial developing and maturing. And had I have gone straight to a traditional workforce or a labor force, or maybe even gotten into college, which wasn't really on the cards, given the academic position I was in, I don't think I would have landed on my feet there anyway. So I definitely needed the time.
How was it that you got back into school? Or you went to an alternative school, or tell me about that?
Yeah, so I went to this thing called an early school leavers program. It's a community training center. So they're not really well known. They're definitely not well advertised. They're run by the Education Training Board of the City of Dublin and the rest of Ireland as well. But they're very rarely signposted to, and they're kind of hard to get into. And, you know, they're usually considered to be for people who, you know, are coming from, you know, serious, serious disadvantages. So for me to kind of get into one of those places, I was really fortunate. And so really the idea there was that they would equip me with skills for the workforce. That we were doing customer service training and business English and just functional maths, mm-hmm, and stuff like that. So, I mean, you know, the work wasn't overly challenging to me, but I think the pace and the kind of small groups and the relationships that you had with your tutors, for me, was finally kind of getting treated like the adult that I thought that I was, which, you know, on reflection, I certainly wasn't, but it was enough for me to kind of start to take myself a little bit more seriously.
It's interesting, though, that you had difficulty in school when you were sort of a lifelong reader, right? I mean, you started reading from a very young age, and yet school didn't work for you. Why is that?
Yeah, I think, you know, whether it's to do where my attention goes or kind of what satisfies me or where I find my satisfaction. I was always a voracious reader, and that was something that was early in primary school, or what you would call elementary school. And that was kind of the first thing that I recognized that I was good at. And it was really celebrated in my house, because I'm not from a family of readers by any means. Not to the extent that I was reading as a child anyway. So it was encouraged.
You volunteered with the, we all know Roddy Doyle's name, and he has an organization called Fighting Words, and you kind of found your way to writing through that. Explain that for me.
Well, I was always writing. Since I started reading books, I kind of realized that I wanted to write them. But you know, you don't have a lot of access to that in the school system. There's maybe a couple of opportunities throughout the year and in your exams where you get to write short fiction or do creative writing. So I was always drawn to fighting words when I was in school and when I had heard of it, but I was never fortunate enough as a student to be brought there. So when the opportunity, just after I'd left school and I'd finished up in that early school leaving course, the opportunity to volunteer there, I had just kind of freshly turned 18 and I was finally eligible for that, was kind of my doorway into the wider literary community in Dublin. And it certainly is a community and it feels very much like one. So being able to access that at a young age, or access parts of that, and you know, be privy to events and meet other writers and just engage with it on a serious level, day in and day out, I think kind of cemented that it was kind of a viable option for me as something that I could pursue, right, find meaning in, you know?
And you were making connections who would help. In your acknowledgements, you thank an author named Declan Hughes, right?
Yeah.
So what did Declan Hughes do for you?
Declan was my first tutor when I was in university, when I was 21. And he was also my dissertation supervisor in my final year. And so he read the first couple of pages of All Them Dogs, which was then a short story called Blue Opal. It was him who, you know, told me that there's something here, you know, that he considered to be quite extraordinary. And so, you know, his excitement for it is really, for me, is what got it off the ground, because I respond well to feedback. And I was in a situation where I was trying to figure out what I wanted to write, and a few things weren't sticking. And so, you know, when he caught the spark of this, was the kind of the green light I needed to go full throttle into it, you know? So he was instrumental in that regard, you know?
So I have a company where I take groups to Europe and we tour around in South America, and we had several trips to Ireland. But my very first one was in 2013, and it was a quote-unquote literary tour of Ireland where we met with authors, and one of them was Declan Hughes.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's a pretty wild coincidence. And so there are 6 degrees. And you would have been, I think, 15 years old at the time.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. But I do remember one question I asked him was about language and writing, in that when you're an Irish writer, maybe aiming for a broader audience, how do you balance? Well, for example, he would use the word strand. We went down to the strand. Americans wouldn't understand the strand necessarily. So do you keep that in mind when you're writing? And I thought of that when I started reading your book, that, you know, you're writing basically in Irish. I mean, in Irish slang, and references to Phoenix Park that a lot of people wouldn't get. But I don't think you could do that any other way, right? And you have to, that you're writing in Tony's voice, and you write the way Tony talks, which is, you know, it takes a while to get into the groove of it. But once you do, it just takes off.
I'm glad. Yeah. I mean, I kind of knew that there were going to be, you know, there would naturally be readers who struggle with it, and then there would be readers who catch it and are open to learning it and kind of catching the rhythm of it. A lot of it is, I mean, there are context clues sprinkled around.
Sure.
But also, like, things like you mentioned the Phoenix Park, he calls it the Pheno, and then you realize that there's just kind of just a bit of abbreviating words and throwing O at the end of them. Like the passenger seat being referred to as the Pato, you know. So yeah, I had to be true to Tony's voice. And, you know, there are times when if I tried to make a sentence kind of more universally coherent, I lost it.
Right.
I said, you know, I kind of have to stick to it and kind of look for other ways to, you know, make it clear that, you know, make it clear about what he's saying.
Well, I mean, if you had dumbed down the language, you would have dumbed down the book, I think, right? You had to.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
Keep it that way. You're from West Dublin, where this book is set. A rough area, rough, tough area?
It's mixed, and it depends. So, I mean, the area I'm from is just this massive, it's the second largest suburb in Dublin, and it's kind of constantly expanding. And, you know, parts of it would have had a reputation maybe in the 90s, like the estate that Mam grew up in, that I live in now. But it's quieted down, but, you know, there's still stuff that happens. And I suppose what interested me about the area and wanted to write about the area is that it's such an amalgamation of different lives. I haven't set this book in a kind of deeply disadvantaged area. I've set it amongst the everyday lives of working class people and lower to upper middle class people, kind of surrounding that. And that speaks to me of the kind of peripheral experiences that I had growing up, where you interface with people from many different walks of life and many different upbringings. And there's, you know, maybe a couple of boys in your class that turn out to be someone like Tony. And maybe you knew them and you kind of experienced their problems and the difficulties that they had in the classroom. And then, you know, you find out what they're doing now and you're kind of like, wow, wow. So I went away, maybe, you know?
Something went wrong somewhere. Guess maybe you just answered my question, but were you at risk of becoming a character like Tony Ward?
I don't think my temperament matched one of Tony's. Like, I think I'm just a little bit too soft to have fully indulged myself in it, but who knows? You know, I think, you know, very much I knew what I wanted out of life, and I wanted to go to university, and I wanted to, you know, surround myself with books, and I wanted to eventually be a writer and whatever else came with that. But there was a time, you know, there was a period where I would have wondered, like, the hell am I going to manage that, and where do I fit in this world? And it just felt very much kind of on the edge, or like I was skirting around the outside of the life everybody else around me was living, and was living with kind of relative ease. For me, a lot of life felt like something I had to endure, and I, you know, which was the problem. The problem that I thought that life was something that had to be endured, I think, is what drew me towards pockets where perhaps there might have been a vacuum that sucked me in. I think there was enough people in my life that kind of kept me grounded, you know, kept my head above water, that, you know, there was a lot of love in my life that I was really appreciative of.
Well, there were people trying to keep Tony's head above water too, and we've referenced him by name and talked about him peripherally, but tell me a little bit about this character, Tony Ward.
Yeah, so, I mean, for Tony, what came to me first was his voice, and it was then this idea of, like, here's this very braggadocious young man with, you know, his chest is puffed up, and he doesn't answer to anyone. He doesn't seem like he wants to answer to anyone, and he doesn't listen, and he's got blinders on, and he's always just moving forward, and he's not going to stop and think about the consequences of anything. He has an idea, it gets into his head, he's going to carry it out, and it's going to work for him. If it doesn't work for him, he's still going to keep pushing. And I really kind of was fascinated because of people in my life that I maybe thought were like that. And I kind of wondered, like, what is the internal life there? You know, what is the part of you that I'm not seeing or not accessing? And so, you know, it became about, like, wanting to explore this type of person's vulnerabilities and finding out what it is they really want, whether they know themselves or not, and whether they admit it to themselves or not. Finding out the ways to find the chinks in that kind of armor and the fragility there.
And he was an enforcer, a gang collector, right? Went out and his immediate, I'll use the word supervisor, but the guy he worked with or worked for after Philly, which, you know, we won't get into it here, but the guy he worked for in this book is a guy named Flute Walsh, Darren Walsh.
Yeah.
Who he ends up having a sexual affair with, in a way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't know how much love there was there, but there was certainly a physical connection.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's like I had these two guys, and for a large part of what I was writing, they were in this car together. And, you know, the situation is that only has come back from England after a time away. But the reason why he was away is because he's done something that other people might want revenge for. So he's kind of constantly got that in the back of his head. So there's an idea that, you know, this kind of established gang member that he's running around with is keeping him safe. And I found that really interesting. And I thought, where can you push that? How far can you push that? And it's just this kind of triangle of fear and admiration and then desire. Like he wants to have the same status as him, but also you can kind of get a sense from Tony that he's someone that wants to be led or feels like he needs to be led. And that's, you know, with his kind of previous mentor who we're not getting into, but, you know, there's kind of hints that there was a similar kind of dynamic there that, you know, he gave him a sense of self and a sense of purpose and that kind of led him along the path that he's on now. And so there's a kind of cycle happening. And again, it's this kind of horseshoe theory of like admiring masculinity so much, it becomes a kind of male love and all of these kind of physical attributes of masculinity, of strength, of power, of dominance. And, you know, how far do you take that? It's going to hit a wall and then you push through that wall. And I think, you know, it's almost inevitable that it becomes erotic.
Right. And so this flute waltz, Tony drive around, they do different things for different gang leaders. And amid this relationship, which becomes even more difficult once more is revealed later in the story. I asked earlier if you might have become a Tony. Tony had trouble with his family. His stepbrother, Archie, they seem to have hated each other. Archie blamed Tony for the way his father treated him. Did you draw on your personal family relationship when you were writing Tony's family relationships?
Yeah, I did. There was, you know, I'm from a kind of high conflict house. You know, with Tony and Archie, I thought they really represented two sides of a very kind of masculine coin, where one was kind of academic but lacked kind of physical prowess maybe Tony had. They both kind of hated each other for being what the other isn't. And so, you know, I wondered, was there some envy there between them? In terms of my own family life, like, I've mixed things around and I've jumbled them up, and, you know, there are parts of me and both of those men.
I like Tony. I feel that Tony's a sympathetic character. I feel like I don't want to keep drawing comparisons to you because this isn't fair, but like you had trouble in school and wanted to be discovered. I feel like Tony just wants to sort of be discovered and found, and through that would find himself. What do you make of that theory?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think what he really wants to feel is a communion. And I think that, well, you know, if we want to draw some comparisons to me, I mean, I think that's something I didn't feel or in school very often, and I always kind of wanted this feeling of having a tribe. And he gets that in these kind of quiet of the book, where it's him and Fanny LaBelle, who's another character, and they have this really nice dynamic that kind of falls away from the rest of the book and creates these little pocket of hopefulness and of calm and of kind of lightness and you know, that are ultimately shifted. And I think it's there that it was writing those scenes that I was kind of figuring out, like, here he is. This is what he wants, really.
Right. You mentioned earlier when we were talking about Declan Hughes that the book comes from a short story named The Blue Opal, which is a car that he kind of inherited or took from his mother. But the Opal's almost a character in this car, in this book, right?
Yeah, totally. And I wanted to call the novel Blue Opal, but it didn't end up. Yeah, I just loved, I loved the romanticization of this, you know, object, this old object that, you know, is kind of incongruous to him in itself, because it's his mother's old car, and it's a boxy little hatchback, and it's not quite a Volkswagen, you know, it's an Opel. And I went through some different iterations as to what ultimately, like, the model should be and what year it should have been made, but I also like that Blue Opal sounds like a gemstone, and, you know, it has a kind of Pink Panther kind of element to it, and, you know, it makes you kind of wonder what it could be, what the Blue Opal actually is. But yeah, the car is his space, the one thing that was his before it was ever his, as he says, you know, but it's, he doesn't seem to have any kind of fixed abode in this novel. He definitely doesn't have a postal address, but he does have this car, and this is the space that he occupies, where he kind of feels like he might be in control.
It's almost like his only love relationship, right?
Affectionate, I think so, yeah. It's
the only affectionate.
Thing, yeah.
So the next book is going to take some of the characters from this book, correct?
Yes, hopefully, if I can make it all work and they can stay in there. But there are characters, there's a lot of characters in this really small book. I'm drawn to them, and I think there's more I can do with them. And it feels like a shame to kind of draw up new characters with the same characteristics when I have these already developed characters that are ripe to be dropped into new situations. So, yeah, hopefully we'll see a few old heads.
Jamel White is the name of the book. Is All Them Dogs? Do you feel pressure with all the praise you're getting?
Pressure? Yeah. Well, I mean, you have to deliver on the next one. I feel like you can mess up the third one and you can mess up the first, but if you did the first goes well, the second can't flop or else it's over.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, yeah. People talk about the sophomore slump, and I don't want to jinx you, but it is a pressure situation. I'm pretty confident after reading All Them Dogs that you're going to be able to live up to the challenge.
Appreciate that, Steve. Thank you.
Listen, it was great to talk to you. Thank you.
It was excellent to talk to you. Thank you.
That's Jamel White. The name of the book is All Them Dogs. You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. I'm glad you are, and I hope you'll listen and subscribe. You can do that at Spotify or Apple Music, WGNRadio.com, wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll be back next week with a discussion with another author. Oh, if you want to give me an email, let me know what you think. Please do that as well. Steve Bertrand on Books @gmail.com. All right, we'll talk to you next time.